This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
When we talk about the power of the internet these days, we usually don't mean anything particularly good. We're thinking about conspiracy theories, trolling, companies harvesting our data, a president using social media to inspire a deadly riot. But that's not the whole picture. It never is. We all live online more and more, and the effects of this new way of life, it's hard to understand and describe. The New Yorker's Katie Waldman has been paying attention to writers whose work tries to capture that uncanny and modern experience. Katie spoke recently with the woman who's been called the poet laureate of Twitter, and not as a joke. Katie, tell me about Patricia Lockwood.
Well, she is a writer who just published her debut novel. It's called No One Is Talking About This. And it's a fascinating text, so we should get back to it in a second. But before we do, it's sort of helpful to know where Lockwood is coming from. She is a creature of the internet, even maybe an imp or a genius of the internet. And she first got attention for her tweets, which are like little stabs of poetry, very funny, raunchy, often extremely bizarre. And something about them seems to tap into the native language of the internet. One tweet that really delighted me is she actually tweeted at the Paris Review's Twitter account, "So is Paris any good or not?" And David, there was no punctuation, no question mark or anything. So it really captured that kind of ironic deadpan of online voice and also kind of the psychotic literalism. But what's really surprising about her writing, I think, is that she actually can command so many different tones and registers. That really goes back to her background as a poet. She has written several books of poetry, and she also has a memoir called Priest Daddy, which is how I first encountered her.
Me too. I love that book. I love Priest Daddy.
It's amazing.
But the new book reads pretty differently. It's much more experimental. In formal terms, how did she make the language of being online constantly, the stuff of a novel?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question because one thing to note about this novel is the protagonist, who's unnamed, very closely resembles Lockwood herself. And the narration of the novel very closely resembles the way your brain sort of skips from tweet to tweet. It's like these little fragments of text. And so it's either a Twitter scroll or it's the broken consciousness of a Twitter user. It's divided into two distinct pieces. And the first half is a pretty naturalistic attempt to conjure kind of the experience of being online. Actually, here's Lockwood reading a passage from that first half as the main character goes online.
She lay every morning under an avalanche of details, blissed, pictures of breakfasts in Patagonia, a girl applying her foundation with a hard-boiled egg, a Shiba Inu in Japan leaping from paw to greet its owner, ghostly pale women posting pictures of their bruises, the world pressing closer and closer, the spider web of human connection grown so thick it was almost a shimmering in solid silk. And the day still not opening to her. What did it mean that she was allowed to see this?
What's interesting is in the second part of the novel, something very dramatic happens in the protagonist's personal life. It is kind of wrenching, and it drives her offline, effectively. And the experience kind of unlocks a different register of expression or even existence for the protagonist. The language itself is more classically beautiful and lyrical. And then something about like the nature of her relationship to the world changes. The mystery of the book is, how do these two halves relate to each other? Is it thesis-antithesis or something more complicated? I talked to Patricia Lockwood recently and got to ask her about all this. So your main character in this book is someone who is extremely online. And I know that that's probably a phrase that you hear 1,000 times doing the press for this book. To you, what does that mean? And what is the experience of the internet that you're trying to capture? And just to like put that in the most fatuous terms possible, do you have a theory of the internet?
It's so interesting to be tagged with a phrase that I would myself never, ever use. They're not just using it, but it's like the headline. It's like, Patricia Lockwood speaks about being extremely online, which is a thing that I would absolutely never say. But yeah, a person who is extremely online has the internet in their bloodstream. It's just rushing and rushing in their veins. And that's something you can feel. It means that you want to pick up your phone and see what's going on when you're not looking at it. It means that you're looking at Twitter while you're pooping. It means all of those things. I mean, that's the easiest definition, right? If you're extremely online, you're looking at Twitter while you're pooping. So I wouldn't say that I have a theory of the internet. It's more of a feeling. It's more of a pulse. It's something that is inside me.
The character becomes a sought-after authority on internet culture, and it's after a tweet of hers goes viral, and the tweet is, "Can a dog be twins?" which I've had many conversations with people in my life about, like, why particularly that's funny. But I'm wondering, how did you settle on that particular joke?
Oh man, when it hits, you just know. It is like when the doctor hits your knee with a hammer and the knee, like your leg kicks out. It had to be something that I thought would actually go viral. So it's not something that I ever posted, but it is just close enough to something that I would post that I think a lot of people would also like and find funny. But yeah, I do present it as a sort of real and plausible job that this person just became famous for those words, "Can a dog be twins?"
At this point, the novel written in fragments is really popular, and actually so popular that it can be somewhat easy to mock. But you chose that structure deliberately. And I was wondering if you could talk about that choice.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have to write in the voice of the portal, and I think that you have to write in the look of the portal as well.
And the portal, of course, is the way that you refer to the internet.
Mm-hmm. And the protagonist also talks about that. I mean, she also is, to a certain extent, mocking it. She says, why were we all writing like this now? You know, why are we all jumping from synapse to synapse, lily pad to lily pad? Partly because this is the way that the portal writes, that we are participating in a way that requires us to make leaps. And this has always been true, I think, of a certain kind of fiction that is composed of fragments that goes back historically a very, very long way.
Yeah. How would you describe the qualities that make your sensibility internet-y? Like, there's this quality of like remixing everything that the world has to offer. And I'm thinking specifically in your novel of a scene that's in a medical setting and there are doctors filing in and out. And one doctor is described as a Madonna in a grotto with a fish-shaped foot, which is just like, where did that come from? That's gorgeous. I don't know, when you think about the way that what you're trying to do with your art coincides with like the way the internet moves and works, what comes up?
So no, it's a really good question. I think I have a metaphorical mind, and I think that I like to make leaps. So I think that what happens with a really good tweet, or you know, something that kind of like makes its way to meme status, something like that, is it makes a leap through the air of the mind, which is also a sort of definition that I've used for poetry. So I would say that one quality that I think is notable is there's a sort of bodilessness to it. It's like anything can happen. You can have any form. You can be a cartoon. You can be a serial mask. You can be gritty. And that's the place that I've always been most at home. I think this is true for people who don't feel wholly comfortable in their bodies. I think that people who want to live on the internet maybe feel that way. And I think that we share that affinity.
So people talk about the experience of being online in often really negative terms, like doom scrolling and hell site. But to you, being online is different, and you write about sort of your arms being full of the sapphires of the instant. How do you find pleasure in this thing that seems to make everyone miserable?
Well, first of all, when I started the book, you know, the term like doom scrolling didn't exist. It wasn't exactly hell world yet. We were on our way there. But I think that what is true for me is that words have always been very tactile. There's something that I feel I can reach out and touch, something that I can smell, something I can turn around in my hand. There's always been this tremendous sense that I could walk among text as through a room of objects or through a forest, something like that. I think that maybe that is why it's pleasant to me.
Yeah. In the second half of the book, the protagonist's sister gets pregnant with a child with a rare genetic disorder called Proteus syndrome, and it's sometimes called Elephant Man's disease. And because of the condition, the baby only lives about 6 months. You've talked about the book as autofiction. From the acknowledgement section, we know that some of this mirrors some of what was happening in your life. And there are moments where the character feels like she can't post about what her family is going through. Maybe there are things that are too raw for the internet. Did you feel that way? And did that affect your decision to maybe put this in the more hospitable form of the novel?
So I have spoken of feeling as if the child had to be put into the book intact, that she had to be settled into it almost as if the book were a cradle for her. So the thing in the book that is true is her syndrome, is what she experienced, is her personality, just all of her. And the reason that the protagonist feels that she can't put her in the portal is because she's not the child's mother. And I very much felt the same way. But for some reason, I had no qualms about putting her into the safety of the book. Thankfully, my sister did not either. I asked her about it right away, and I said, I am writing about Lena. I can't keep myself from writing about her. Is that okay? And it was, and it made her happy. And there's a sense that she will be memorialized. You know, when a child only lives 6 months, there is a bold question. And that question is, who remembers her? How do they remember her? Do they remember her as a human being or only a series of soft sensations? But she had such a distinct personality that I thought, I can preserve that. I can put that into the cradle of the book and I can rock it and I can keep her safe there.
So I'd love to ask you to read another passage that takes place right after the birth of the baby.
She found herself so excited by the baby that she could hardly stand it. She was doing so well. She was stupendous. In every reaching cell of her, she was a genius, just like the man with the basketball whose body always knew what to do. Her eyes traveled and traveled, though she could not see, would not be able to see. It was immediately clear. There were drops of wild dragon scale fluorescence where her irises ought to be. So what? That every person on earth might be watched in that way, given a party whenever she waved and raised her little arms, breathed just like the rest of us, turned to hear a voice she knew. The news. It was a marvel how cleanly and completely this lifted her out of the stream of regular life. She was a gleaming, sterilized instrument, flashing out at the precise moment of emergency. She chugged hot hospital coffee and then went, ah, like George Clooney on ER, like she was off to go slice out the tumor that had lately been pressing on the world's optic nerve. She wanted to stop people on the street and say, do you know about this? You should know about this. No one is talking about this.
Thank you so much. So that reading, of course, gets back to the title of the novel, No One Is Talking About This. What is the this?
That's a good question. It's a very encompassing word. And it is funny to think that even the title is taken sort of from meme language. But I just sort of think of this as like the umbrella that we're holding over us. It's everything. It's what is encompassed in our experience of the world. In that moment, you know, she wants to speak to everyone in the world. She wants everyone to hear these words. Do you know about this? She wants to show everyone the same picture. So there are times, I think, when one word becomes the biggest thing in the world and it absolutely holds everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating because the arrival of the baby is sort of a turning point or a volta.
Volta, that's so good. Do you know my first book of poetry was called Volta? You know that sweet first book of poetry that's so terrible that you're convinced is this work of genius and you sleep with it under your pillow and you pray not to get hit by a car before the world sees it? Mine was called Volta.
Oh my gosh. Well, here it is, reincarnated.
Yes.
But I mean, certainly the tone doesn't recede, and even a lot of the concerns of the first part don't necessarily recede, but they're suddenly collaged with this powerful reminder of the life that happens offline. And in a way, the second half reveals the depths beneath the shallows of the first half. Like, it doesn't necessarily knock over everything that the first half has established. It sort of says... Like this same collectivity, this like openness and abundance and receptivity, like that can also be expressed in this like singular person.
Yeah. And I like the word abundance because I think that that is what she feels or what she felt originally in the portal. I do think she feels greater abundance with the baby. But there's a line at the end where she does talk about how she entered the portal because she wanted to delight and to be delighted. And that's something that is easier to achieve with a child. It's harder sometimes to be delighted by and delight the world. The contrast is there, but I think that these two impulses partake of each other. I think they do deepen each other.
Yeah. So you see these documentaries coming out about how social media is rotting our brains, and there's a kind of pessimism there about the internet right now. Do you think that pessimism is warranted, or is there a more nuanced way to think about what the internet should do or be?
I think there's always a more nuanced way, but it is easy to be in a black mood about the internet at this moment in time. But I don't think that it's a permanent mood. I mean, it's still the place where we go to congregate, to gather. And I think that there can always be beauty and good power in that. And I think that the darker things will stay with us. But as long as we can gather in a place, I think that there is hope.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Katie.
Patricia Lockwood. Her new novel is called No One Is Talking About This, and you can read Katie Waldman on books of all kinds at newyorker.com.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.